Gerritsen and Toth presents The Shift with Jack Johnson on ESPN Kansas City, 1510 AM and 94.5 FM.
Another day, another edition of The Shift on 94.5 FM and 1510 AM ESPN Kansas City. I'm your host, Jack Johnson, alongside Marco Marquez. Shout out to our presenting sponsors, starting with Gerritsen and Toth. They handle the most complex felony, federal, or state criminal defense cases. You'll find they've been doing that successfully, helping criminal defendants all over the Kansas City area and Northeast Kansas for years. Also a shout out to Active Family Chiropractic. If you're dealing with any neck, back, shoulder, or any type of pain, go in today and schedule an appointment. Their office is located on 135th and Antioch in Overland Park, Kansas. Or just give them a call at 913-681-6013. That's 913-681-6013. Stop dealing with those nagging pains that keep you up at night and call Active Family Chiropractic today. Though we're still a few months out from training camp, from the NFL preseason, there's a pressing matter with the Kansas City Chiefs that I feel like we haven't been able to address since the draft, since free agency started, well, I guess since free agency started a little bit. But what is the weakest point of this team now? After the draft, after some minor depth moves, what is the weakest point for the Kansas City Chiefs, and what is the concern level? Now, we didn't get to talk about it much yesterday when going over the Melvin Ingram signing with the Miami Dolphins, just a one-year, $5 million deal. But that was another guy off the market the Chiefs could have added. Now, at that type of price, it appears the Chiefs were never really interested in Melvin Ingram, or at least bringing him back. They may have liked to bring him back, but in the end, they weren't going to make the move, spend the money, or put it on the top of their priority list. It appears the Chiefs are going to go into training camp gambling on the guys that they already have. They feel maybe Frank Clark is in a good position. They feel like first-round pick George Karloftis is a guy that can start and play three of the four downs. I mean, if he's got that type of motor they're all talking about, and he's got that type of power and that ability to beat guys one-on-one, maybe that's your fix at the edge position. Now you go with the depth pieces. Is no move in free agency with the exception of Taylor Stallworth on the front line. Is it maybe indicating that the Chiefs are higher on Josh Kando than we may think? I saw Sterling Holmes, who has the home stretch here later on today, he tweeted that out, that maybe the development of Josh Kando has exceeded some expectations. We'll have to see in camp just what he looks like. I think we're pretty knowledgeable of what Mike Dana will bring you this year. But sometimes in these scenarios, when a front office like the Kansas City Chiefs doesn't make a move, it doesn't always mean that they made the wrong move. Maybe betting on your guys who are cheaper, who are younger, could help you in the long run. I mean, won't we all feel stupid if Frank Clark plays as good as he had in the 2019-2020 postseason run? I mean, what if you get that version of Frank Clark? What if George Karloftis was the steal of the first round? What if Josh Kando can give you 14 games and 5.5 or 6 sacks? I mean, that's the type of depth pieces maybe Kansas City already possesses. Now, I know we all wanted to see Melvin Ingram. We wanted to see him back. He was great in a Chiefs uniform. He was one of the few guys up front in the postseason that made an impact. All right, Chris Jones didn't have a sack in the postseason. Melvin Ingram did. Frank Clark struggled to beat guys one-on-one. Melvin Ingram did. But the Chiefs looked at their edge problems, and they said, if we can add a first-round talent, we like the front four. And you may not like it, I may not like it, Marco may not like it. But the starting defensive front will include Frank Clark, it'll include Derek Nnadi, it'll include Chris Jones, and it will include George Karloftis. That is your starting four, barring any injuries. Now, if there's injuries, then the Chiefs might have shot themselves in the foot, because if it happens at the edge position, let's say Frank Clark isn't healthy to start the year, you're rolling with Kando or Dana. That's what you've locked yourself into. Now, I believe that throughout the preseason, throughout training camp, the Chiefs still may pick up some guys that were released by other clubs. You know, there will be guys that are dropped in the preseason. The Chiefs can try to place a claim on them, or maybe go out and get a cheap one-year deal. There are depth pieces to add. You're not going to get an impact starter. You're going to have rotational guys. But the Chiefs have put themselves in a spot where it's, we're betting on our guys. And they did it last year. They did it with their secondary group as well. The only cornerback they added last year was Mike Hughes. And it was via trade. You rolled with Charvarius Ward. You rolled with Rashad Fenton. You were rolled with L'Jarius Sneed. I mean, those were your guys. And a year after, you lost a couple. But that's the Chiefs in the cornerback position. The Chiefs in the edge position, that was one they kind of tried to address last year. You bring back Alex Okafor. I mean, Taco Charlton was there to start the year. He didn't make it through camp. But the Chiefs were confident that Frank Clark was going to return to form. They thought Chris Jones on the edge was going to work. They thought Jaron Reed and Derek Nnadi in the middle were going to provide much more of an impact than they really did. Now, Jaron Reed did make an impact late in the season, but weeks 1 through 15, he was pretty much non-existent. So there have been some moves that have made you scratch your head going into training camp, but at this point, with what the Chiefs have done through the draft and what most national NFL analysts are saying, with it was a home run draft for Brett Veach, maybe he does deserve the benefit of the doubt going into this year. Now, if the edge group is a total disaster, right, George Karlaftis is a bust, Frank Clark can't stay healthy, and at one point in the season you're starting Dana and Josh Kando on either side of each other, then you do have cause for concern. You can criticize the offseason the Chiefs had, but the edge position, it was a very expensive market. It still is. There are two guys out there the Chiefs could add. Now, it's going to cost a lot. They could go out and get Robert Quinn from the Chicago Bears. They could go out and get Jadeveon Clowney. Two guys right there, immediate impact starters. But I don't see the Chiefs making a move like that, because you drafted George Karlaftis in the first round to be a starter, and you brought back Frank Clark to be a starter. If Frank Clark wasn't a starter, the Chiefs would have cut him. So do you view Frank Clark as a rotational guy if you went out and got Jadeveon Clowney or Robert Quinn? Well, somebody would have to be a rotational guy, and I don't know if the Chiefs want George Karlaftis to be that. Marco, when you look at the edge group, on a scale of 1 to 10, we're still, I guess it'd be training camp is in July, is it? So we're still about 2 months out from training camp. What's the concern level after the draft and the Chiefs seemingly standing pat with their edge group? They didn't give Melvin Ingram an extra $600K to come back to Kansas City. They feel pretty confident, it appears, in their edge group. But what is your concern level, 1 to 10?
Yeah, talk about putting your money where your mouth is. In this case, the Chiefs were saving some of their cap space by not giving that additional $600,000, like you said, to Melvin Ingram. So my concern, I mean, every team has something that always has question marks going into the season. There is no perfect team out there, especially in the NFL. My level of concern right now with the defensive line is maybe at a 5. A 5, because there's unproven talent at the position, but also and we know what Frank Clark and Chris Jones bring to the table, but we also know they're not game-changing X-factor type of players. Maybe Chris Jones throughout the regular season, but we always talked about this new era of Mahomes is getting to the postseason, and we've talked about it off-air plenty of times. Chris Jones doesn't have a postseason sack. He is he's a factor, no doubt about it. He played a substantial role in the Chiefs' Super Bowl run by being that tall wall at the line in the interior and blocking the quarterback's vision. But like I said, unproven talent with Karlaftis, although I am not too concerned that he will be ready to go week one, barring any injuries or anything. But Kando, Mike Dana, I'm big on Mike Dana, but he's good for one or two games a year right now, at least of what we've seen in the past. He can play the defensive end position at the National Football League, but he's not just a. There's a reason why he hasn't formed into the starter role, and that's why on the opposite side of Frank Clark, there is going to be a competition at training camp as to who earns that starting role. Maybe we see a change in the defensive schemes. Maybe we see the Chiefs go back to a 3-4 in a sense, but at the same time, you don't have enough edge guys to run that type of schematic defense. So it's one of those things. I like Tershawn Wharton, but is he ready for that next step up at this level? Is he ready to take his game another step, his role on this team? So tying it over back to baseball with the rotation, you could say that in comparison to the questions that we had about the Royals going into the season, those things can be said about the guys, or about those questions can be asked too about this defensive line of the Kansas City Chiefs going into the regular season, because you got your two pieces right there in Clark and Jones. Naughty, he's consistent year in and year out. There's a reason why they brought him back. But now we got to see the young guys. What's next for them? Because like you said, there's free agents out there. They're gonna have to open up their checkbook for him. But it's their choice whether or not they're gonna do that, or they're gonna roll with who they got going into this next season.
And I do want to see who they roll with, and I want to see who they trust, because sometimes one guy just emerges, whether that be from an undrafted free agent class. No, Turk Wharton showed up out of nowhere, Missouri S&T. And Turk Wharton played some snaps and made an impact with a couple snaps that he had in his rookie season. Now, for a guy like Josh Kando, who is built like a freak, he is actually built very similar to what Tano Passanio was. And I hope he doesn't have the same career trajectory that Tano Passanio had, being a 6'7", 6'8", 270-pound edge rusher. But it's hard to, I guess, predict a different outcome when we knew about the problems he had coming out of college. Can't stay healthy. He's not fundamentally very sound. He's not uber quick off the ball. But he does have long arms and he's a freak athlete. And at this level, when you look at the edge position, how do you beat guys one-on-one? It's not necessarily the guys with brute strength. They just dominate left and right tackles in this league. There's very few that can do that. Most of the time, it's with footwork. It's with what you're doing with your arms, your hands. How quick are you off the ball? And Kando really wasn't that coming out of college. He was a 5-star recruit, went to Florida State, and you know, just couldn't stay on the field, couldn't stay healthy, and then got hurt in his first year with Kansas City. Not saying he can't get to that level, because I believe with the right coaching, and the NFL usually has the right coaching, the Chiefs have the right coaching, and I think the perfect situation for him. But the Chiefs are not going to wait long on guys like Josh Kando and Mike Dana to be rotational depth pieces. And this is their year. This is their year going into it, thinking we are one injury away. They're not rooting for injuries, obviously, but they know that their role on this team could go from 10 snaps a game to being a starter. Because if Frank Clark, who has shown he can't be healthy in the last couple of years, if he goes down, it's Dana or Kando. If George Karlaftis, for whatever reason, battled a nagging injury, don't want to say a knee injury, just battled an injury, then they're up next. The Chiefs are going to have to find who they can trust and can get to the quarterback very quickly through camp and through the preseason. Not that it can tell you everything, but they don't have much depth. They really don't. It's the same guys they've had the last couple of years. On the interior, it's Colin Saunders, it's Taylor Stallworth, it's Turk Wharton, if you want to put Wharton in that conversation, or at the edge position, whatever you want to do with him. But it's Dana and Kando behind Clark and behind Karlaftis. unless they were to make a move to go get Jadeveon Clowney or Robert Quinn, those are your starters. And I'm not ruling it out, right? I think Jadeveon Clowney this late in the game is probably going to sign another one-year deal. And if Kansas City could give him a one-year, $13 million deal, would you do it? Would you do it with more confidence that you have a every-down starter, but it bumps either Clark or Karlaftis off the starting group? Now, some of you out there will say, well, yeah, I'd definitely have Clowney in front of Clark. Well, you're also paying Clark a lot of money to be a rotational guy. It may not matter to you. You may say, hey, whatever gets you a Super Bowl, whatever gets you back to a Super Bowl, I'm fine with. I don't care what we're paying a rotational guy. And maybe Frank Clark plays better as a rotational guy. We don't know because we've never seen it. He's always been a starter or he's not been on the field. Like I said, they could make a move, but as we're getting closer and closer to training camp, it feels like the Chiefs are pretty set with their defense. I don't see them adding much more unless some bombshell announcement is made in the next 2 months. I'd give it about 15% chance of happening, though, maybe less. Marco, for a guy like Jadeveon Clowney or a guy like Robert Quinn, what's the confidence level? I don't want to say confidence level. What's the likelihood the Chiefs make a move like that? Between 1 and 99.9%.
Give me 1 second. Let me look up the Chiefs cap space right now because I don't think anything is out of question.
They still got to extend Orlando Brown.
Still got to extend Brown. Let's see. As of right now, still looking at, roughly with the trade of Tyreek Hill, we all know, opened up some or created some space for them. They do have some money to play with. Right now, the Chiefs are sitting at $11 million in space. But, of course, I think we will know after the Chiefs get Orlando Brown Jr. extended. I think that's one of their higher priorities right now, the top priority. And once that's made, they'll know how much money they have left to work with in order to go out and sign a defense, sign another asset on the defensive line. Because Robert Quinn and Jadeveon Clowney, those are guys that are going to be starters. Like you said, you sign them to start on your defensive line. Melvin Ingram was not going to be that guy for Kansas City. He was not going to be a starter, a three-down defensive end. No. So at the end of the day, although they may not be getting the talent as Melvin Ingram, and if they don't go after Quinn and Clowney, let's say they get signed between now and the time the Chiefs extend Orlando Brown, which I do think is going to get done before training camp, then I'm sure there's somebody out there on the market that Brett Veach has his eye on and knows that not only can he maybe sign him for less than $4.4 million, because that's how much they were going to give Ingram, right? 4.4?
Yeah, about 4.4.
$4.4 million. At the end of the day, he could still go get his guy, and you got a draft pick out of it. So maybe you don't have to spend as much as you were on Ingram, but maybe you get somebody who can mix in with Karlaftis, Clark, and Dana. Maybe we're going to see, going back to baseball, we're going to see a bullpen start type of?
Bullpen game, yep.
Yeah, a bullpen game as far as the rotation goes with the defensive end, which I, for one, like because it always gives something different for the offensive tackles you're going up against. Imagine just a fresh going up against a fresh defensive end on each down, because the tackles, they don't take time off unless they're pulled for a extra tight end or something. There is maybe something here with Brett Veach working on and Andy Reid and Steve Spagnuolo where they're like, let's try to throw off the offensive tackles and beat them with just different pieces and freshness, because I think Leo Chenault, I think he's more going to be going in. I think we're looking at maybe a possible defensive end role for him also, as long with Karlaftis, because from what I've heard or from what we've heard, high motor, violence, aggressive. Shoot, if I were an offensive tackle and I was going up against a guy that was just first of all a different guy each time, but also somebody that can bring energy, then That right there is a formula I could see the Chiefs going in.
Not saying that he would be the type of player. I don't want to put this type of pressure on Leo Chenal, but that's kind of what Derek Johnson did at his role of a linebacker, middle linebacker, but also at times would be a heavy blitzer. And I don't know if you're meaning Leo Chenal has to be a guy that it's lining up on the edge or if it's a guy that's occasionally coming down on the blitz.
Yeah, down on the blitz. There you go. Like a Dan Sorensen type role. Hey, he wasn't good at covering either. So
yeah, I mean, that's one way to not get him exposed. Now, Robert Quinn and Jadeveon Clowney aren't the only guys out there that are edge rushers on the market. They could go Jason Pierre-Paul. They could go Akeem Hicks from the Bears. They could go Jadeveon Clowney, as we just mentioned. Carlos Dunlap, another guy. Takaris McKinley. I mean, there are other names out there that could not be starters. Carlos Dunlap would not be a starter. He's getting up there in age, though, 33 years old. Takaris McKinley, younger, 26 years old. He was with Cleveland last year. There are guys. There are guys the Chiefs could add for cheap and to be depth pieces. Maybe they do. Maybe they don't. They roll with the guys that they have. Right now, it's just such a toss-up, but at least we know the starting front four. I think it's about depth pieces at this point for the Kansas City Chiefs. When we come back here on the shift, we'll talk some Royals baseball. Are they going to get younger, or is it all just a mirage as we get closer and closer to the All-Star break? You're listening to The Shift on 94.5 FM and 1510 AM ESPN Kansas City. Welcome back into The Shift on 94.5 FM and 1510 AM ESPN Kansas City. I'm your host, Jack Johnson, alongside Marco Marquez. In thrilling fashion, I don't know if you can really use the word thrilling in a loss, but the Royals did lose in thrilling fashion last night. It was a boring game through 7.5 innings. And then finally, the Royals offense had a little bit of a pulse. And I know we're all out there expecting Alex Zumwalt, Mike Tosar to make an immediate impact. That's just not how hitting coaches work, by the way. If you were one of the people out there last night with Johnny Cueto dealing against the Royals lineup and blaming Alex Zumwalt and Mike Tosar, the two new hitting coaches for the Kansas City Royals. By the way, we didn't get to get to that yesterday because they fired the Royals, that is, fired Terry Bradshaw about 30 minutes after the show ended. But with Alex Zumwalt, or Zumwalt, that is, excuse me, I keep pronouncing that wrong, Alex Zumwalt and Mike Tosar moving into the hitting coach's role, it's going to take about a month or two to really see if the changes are happening or not. Now, maybe with the praise he's gotten, there's a better chance it happens earlier. But I saw some Royals fans last night on Twitter overreacting to the Royals being shut out through 7.5 innings. It didn't matter if you brought the best hitting coach in the game over to Kansas City's locker room before the game. You're not going to have those changes, right? It's about the adjustments that are made over time. So the Royals were shut out 3-0 going into the bottom of the 8th inning. Then some old school Royals baseball started to happen. Michael A. Taylor gets an infield single. Ryan O'Hearn, who's actually been pretty good in the pinch hitting role, I believe now 4-for-5 on the season, he rips a single against the shift. So you got first and third, nobody out. Kyle Isbell strikes out. Whit Merrifield doubles off the wall in left field. And then Andrew Benintendi ties the game on an RBI single on a 3-0 count, by the way, to make it 3-3 off Kendall Graveman, one of the league's best setup mans. So the Royals get 3 in the 8th. And you're starting to feel not necessarily better about this team, but they didn't fold. And I'm not trying to give moral victories to the Royals, but even last night, after a 5-3 loss in extra innings, yeah, Scott Barlow made another one-pitch mistake to the Chicago White Sox, and Luis Robert pounded it 430 feet from home plate. Listen, it happens. Luis Robert's a great player. Scott Barlow's still a great reliever for the Royals, and he was pitching just fine for the first 5 batters that set them all down. But it's that one pitch that sometimes just gets away from him. He left a curveball a little too up in the zone, and Robert, as most good hitters do, punished the mistake. But I did not walk away from last night's game with anger, with fury. I really didn't. Because the Royals did something that they hadn't done in the first 32 games. They genuinely competed for the last 3 innings when they were pretty much down and out. I mean, that's not excusing the atrocious plate appearances they were having in innings 1-7. Right, that's the reason they lost. They couldn't get anything going off a 36-year-old who was making his first start of the season. right? That type of thing, or that type of stuff, that needs to change. And that's what you're hoping Alex Zumwalt and Mike Tosar can do. Now, they did strike out a lot last night, and that's something that is going to be a constant unless other things change, that Zumwalt can change, is strikeouts. Though the Royals don't do it a lot, the other end is that they want to put the ball in play. It's not to drive in runners. It's not to get on base. It's not to hit it out of the ballpark. The Royals' hitting philosophy is let's not strike out. Let's put the ball in play. But then games like last night, you strike out double digits or in the double digits. That's not making your team better. The Royals are fourth worst in the league in on-base percentage. They have the lowest strikeout rate, but the fourth worst on-base percentage. So you tell me what you really want. Clearly, not striking out does nothing for your offense. And the Royals need to change that concept because games like last night are a pretty big indicator why the Royals' offense struggled so heavily through 32 games. And even Dayton Moore and J.J. Piccolo, when they took the podium yesterday or answered the questions from media, their philosophy hasn't changed. It's that you got to put the ball in play still. That's just not what wins games anymore at the big league level. But back to the game, back to the overall just outcome of the game. The Royals lose 5-3. They struck out a lot. But I did not walk away with rage and fury about the Royals' 21st loss in 33 games. No, at least I can look at it now and say the Royals addressed a big-time problem, which was making a statement, showing that you genuinely care about what the Royals had done through 32 games. They fired Terry Bradshaw. Now I feel like they have the right two guys in the clubhouse to change that approach. Alex Zumwalt is highly regarded by a lot of people in the Royals organization. Same with Mike Tosar. And for them to get things turned around, it's about building the relationships first, getting the respect of the players. And I think some of them have already built that connection. Now, Terry Bradshaw has been some of these guys' only hitting coaches at the big league level. But it's about building that connection, because what can happen when a hitting coach or a pitching coach builds connection? Well, that player becomes more open to listening what that coach has to say. If you do not build a connection, if you have a disconnect, players are going to stop listening. They're going to say, well, clearly you're not giving me tips that are making me successful. I'm looking around the league. I'm looking at other former Royals players, and they're finding success elsewhere. Clearly, you were the one that derailed their career. So for the Royals to get to the level where they want to be, number one, it's going to start with building the relationship, building that connection between the coaches. And where I think that is really going to start, where that's really going to start happening, is when the Royals bring up a lot of their young talent in AAA. Vinny Pasquantino, Nick Prado, playing Kyle Isbell every single day, playing MJ Melendez every single day. Because Alex Zumwalt and Mike Tosar, they've worked with those young hitters. They already have that connection. Now, guys like Whit Merrifield or Michael A. Taylor or Andrew Benintendi, they've been around long enough where they don't have that connection. It's going to come down to, do they respect that coach? Do they respect what he's telling them? We'll have to wait and see. But last night, I decided I'm done getting annoyed. I'm done with getting irritated with players that are simply not going to be here in 2 months. I'm not going to continue to harp and complain and moan about Carlos Santana being in the lineup, because I know now it's only a matter of time. It wouldn't have been that way if Terry Bradshaw was still here, because now with Alex Zumwalt and Mike Tosar up there, the idea is that young players are going to slowly start filtering their way up. And why I mean slowly, actually, I mean in the next couple of weeks. I see Vinny Pasquantino or Nick Prado being on this roster before the end of May. Because the Royals are going to come to a point where they say, all right, now that Zumwalt has been in the club for, or been at the major league level, been in the dugout, been in the clubhouse with the Royals for the last couple of weeks, now we can start filtering in some of those guys that he's worked with. And Nick Prado is one of them. Maybe they go with Nick Prado over Vinny Pasquantino first because they want a first baseman, a fundamentally sound first baseman, a first baseman that can handle the hot corner. But the Royals are going to move into that direction of getting younger. And that's why I'm not going to get upset about games in which they lose to a good team last night I'm not going to sit here and place blame on Carlos Santana going 0-for-4 or Michael A. Taylor striking out to start the top of the 10th. I'm just not going to, because they're not going to be here much longer. You know, I'm not going to continue to complain about Ryan O'Hearn, who's hitting cleanup today. Hey, it's fine. It's either Ryan O'Hearn or it's Carlos Santana. Pick your poison. It's pretty much the same to me at this point. So until Nick Prado comes up or Vinny Pasquantino, I'm not going to lose my mind about what's happening at first base. Now, if Nick Prado and Vinny Pasquantino come up and they're playing Carlos Santana over him, then I'm going to get back to that frustration. But the Royals did exactly what I wanted them to do. They needed to make a statement. They needed to make changes with their coaching staff. I'm assuming Cal Eldred is very much on the hot seat. It's about when they can make that move. And by the way, I don't think they decided on Sunday that Terry Bradshaw was out. I don't think they just sat there on the flight back home from Denver and said, okay, now we're done with Terry Bradshaw, after the Royals had had their highest offensive output in a series all year. No, this probably was in the works for the last 2 weeks. You know, probably after that loss to the Cardinals, where they'd been shut out for the third time in 5 games, the Royals started to make those moves internally. Getting Alex Zumwalt prepared, getting Mike Tosar prepared to take over in 2 weeks. The very same could be happening with Cal Eldred. So that's where it needs to become a situation where it's a wait and see. Because now the Royals have actually made the move, had actually made that coaching change. Now you know it's possible with somebody on that staff. They're not going to completely gut the coaching staff. They're not going to gut the organization. That happens in the offseason. That's when it can happen in the offseason. But overall, I'm not going to be up in arms about losses like last night. Some of you, you want to be upset about a game in which you come back, you claw and you scratch and claw back only to lose in extras. Yeah, I mean, the Royals are not the first team to have that happen. The reality is, the Royals roster is not good enough to beat good teams in games like that. It can happen every once in a while. It's baseball. There's 162 games. But they're just not to that level yet. Now, next year, if you have these young studs up at the major league level, you have Bobby Witt Jr. at the corner, you have Vinny Pasquantino in the lineup, you have MJ Melendez in the lineup, you have Nick Prado in the lineup, and Kyle Isbell. Then you go spend money, and then you're underachieving. You spend money on the rotation, you spend money corner outfield spot, you extend Andrew Benintendi, and maybe some of these guys are turning it around. Then yeah, with a much better roster, I'm getting irritated at this point with a 12-21 start. But I think once you reel it back and say, yeah, this team's going to be better than 12-21, and I truly do believe that. I probably now say this team wins about 75 games, 75 to 77 wins. I mean, there's going to be some stretch here in June or July where they look really good and the young players are playing well. But right now, I'm done losing my mind over players that aren't going to be here in a few weeks playing poorly. Because is it really that much of a shock? I mean, are we expecting Carlos Santana to win Silver Slugger? Are we expecting Ryan O'Hearn to be a participant in the home run derby? No. No, I mean, that's who they are at this point. Carlos Santana had a fantastic career. And, you know, I'm not going to place all the blame on Carlos Santana. He doesn't have much protection in the lineup. You know, he's going to play out next month or two, and the Royals will probably make a decision there because the Royals will have young guys to take his spot. But you don't need to put all of your frustration and your anger towards guys like that, because they're not the reason the Royals are losing games. Last night, that's not really a bad loss. Yeah, the first 7 innings were ugly, but you scratch and claw, you force extra innings. You got some sort of pulse of the offense. And yeah, Scott Barlow made one mistake. It cost him the game, but that's baseball. The Royals were competitive last night. What do we want to see? For me, at this point, the rest of the summer, it's competitive baseball. Wins and losses are going to happen. I don't want to see 10-0 shutouts. I don't want to see 7-1 losses. If you beat Colorado the way you did on Sunday, you win a series and then you lose 5-3 in extras. Let's say you split the doubleheader today, but your one loss is a 4-3 loss. You blow the game late. Yeah, it's really frustrating, but it's not so much of a moral victory. I need to see competitiveness, because when you play the young players like they do in today's game one lineup, you want to see them compete at the major league level. That's all I ask for with a roster that I know is not going to make the postseason. Make it fun. If you're not winning a lot of games, at least your losses, make them fun to watch. Make them entertaining. Make the fan tune in for all 9 innings. Right? Make them want to wait and see for that comeback. Like last night, it's 3-0. The Royals had two hits going into the eighth inning, but still, I had this feeling that they get two runners on, maybe they can make something happen. They made something happen. They tied the game. And Scott Barlow was one batter away from giving the Royals a win because the Royals would have walked it off in the bottom of the 10th. What would have happened? Michael A. Taylor probably would have bunted, got Bobby Witt Jr. to third, and Nicky Lopez, hopefully, I know he struck out in the bottom of the 10th, but it's a different situation at the plate, probably wouldn't have been able to drive him in. So this team is not on the cusp of going on a tear, but I think they're on the cusp of becoming more competitive. It feels like a spot where when you are this competitive, or when you're trying to be competitive, that's when the streaks start to happen, when you know you're close. The Royals had not been close until maybe that series in Colorado, winning 14-10, winning 8-7, and then barely losing yesterday. Hey, maybe it's all smoke and mirrors. Maybe I'm being too optimistic. But last night, I was not frustrated. I wasn't really frustrated at all. And that's a game where you're usually really frustrated, but not for me. Marco, what about you? I mean, the Royals, 12-21. They still have four more against the White Sox and then three against the Twins over the weekend. I'm just not going to get frustrated over close losses anymore for the Royals because I know their roster isn't good enough to be competitive at this level. Now, Jason Justice just stepped into the studio real quick, showing a whiteboard to whatever Marco's looking at. So I'll wait until Marco is done with his conversation. But yeah, it's one of those situations where I'm trying to convey to the fan, don't get mad at the bad roster for losing a close game to a good team. Yeah, we want to be frustrated because of the way things have gone. I don't know, though. It's much better to watch this team when you're not expecting the world from them. What about you? Are you still expecting the world from this Royals team at 12-21?
No. And I never expected the world from them to start the season. I did have, you know, the fandom gotten me a little bit before the season. I was like, yeah, if everything clicks right, then this is a playoff team. But I think you talked about yesterday's game, just not getting heated over it, not frustrated. I think I was the same way because I think yesterday's just breaking news with the firing of Bradshaw. And now I feel like there's, I don't know, more concerning questions with the Royals than the player. And it goes beyond the players that are being put out there each day. It's like, do they have two hitting coaches now? Why did four different people speak yesterday on the firing of Terry Bradshaw? I think now yesterday's move. Although I am curious to see the changes that do come after it. Player progression. How will the offense look going forward? Because we haven't even gotten through a quarter through the season. It's only been 36 games. There's a lot of baseball left. But I think that they are who they are for right now. And if they if the Royals can start winning some games off, maybe winning some series. I don't know. Was that Rocky series their first series win of the year?
No, it was our first series win since, I want to say, Chicago.
See, and that
it's been too long.
Exactly. They need to start stringing together some more of those. Maybe you're not winning every series by all means, but you're winning at least more than one a month. It's at this point I've just accepted that the Royals, who are they are. Can it get better? Yes. I don't think it's going to get worse, though. And yesterday's change of coaches, I think, was a sign of it. And I think now it really is just a matter of time until we see Prado and Pascatino. But I think they're going to I don't know, man. It's just they are who they are, unfortunately, for better or for worse. But at the end of the day, I think that there is a horizon, but we're not getting there this season, unfortunately.
No, certainly not. I don't want to sent out this message that I don't care what happens, and I'm still getting frustrated by loss. I don't want to say that I completely was over the moon about a loss.
There was a lot
of
news yesterday where it's like, oh, crap, there's a baseball game still going on.
Exactly. There was much more positive yesterday than I think negative. Yeah. And the reason it's positive is because the Royals might have just had the first domino fall. And that's why I think yesterday's loss was not doom and gloom for me. If Terry Bradshaw was still there, then it would have been. Because it would have been, here's the same problem over and over again, and you're still not doing anything. But the change yesterday, I think, is the first domino to fall. The next is they're going to start weeding out some of the players that we know are going to be gone a couple of months.
Yeah.
The younger players are up. Then Cal Eldred's probably on the way out. And as we get through this season, we'll have younger players, a new staff, and you'll feel better about the direction. Not saying it's going to result in winning 30 of 40 games, but you'll at least get to see a glimpse of the future, which we've been asking for 4 to 5 years. What can this young talent bring to Kansas City? And if they can give you that confidence going into the offseason, then the front office will go, now it's time to spend money. You know, Nick Prado, Vinny Pasquantino, we feel comfortable with them. Bobby Witt Jr. in a full season, we know we can roll with Bobby Witt. Andrew Benintendi will give him the extension. Kyle Isbell, maybe Edward Olivares once he's back from his quad injury. You feel comfortable with a platoon situation in the outfield. There are other pieces they can go with, right? And I think yesterday, I'm not saying watch every Royals game now and be okay with what happens just because Zoom Walt and Mike Tosar are here. No, it's that it's the first domino of many to fall in the right direction for Kansas City. That's what I'm trying to say.
Exactly. And it just stinks that it's because it's we were told by Dayton Moore, 2021, 2022, that time right there was going to be the next that was supposed to be 2013 and 2014-ish. But fortunately now it's time to rinse and but not repeat because like you said, they got a different direction now, and I think so too. And, yeah, the Sparks yesterday, the fact that they were able to come back, they showed life in the last three innings of the game was good. They were fighting for a comeback yesterday. They forced extra on Chicago. But like you said, here we go for the next 3 or 4 years again.
Exactly. It's not a blow-up situation. You don't need to blow up the Royals. You need to make changes to repair. I would say repair where the Royals are at right now. And there's going to be a lot of changes, I think, coming to this coaching staff, maybe the front office in the offseason, but it also depends on how they finish out the season. The Royals do have a doubleheader today against the Sox. Game one, the lineup has been released. It'll be John Heasley going up against Dylan Cease, who the Royals saw earlier in Chicago. Whit Merrifield will lead off. He'll play second. Andrew Benintendi hitting second, playing left field. Salvi will hit third and DH. Ryan O'Hearn hitting cleanup, playing first base. Hunter Dozier in right field. He'll hit fifth. Bobby Witt Jr. hitting sixth. He'll play third base. MJ Melendez will do the catching and hit seventh. Kyle Isbell will play center field and hit eighth. And Nicky Lopez will round it out and hit ninth at shortstop. Then in game two, Brady Singer, who was called up as the 27th man in the doubleheader, he will make the start. The White Sox have yet to name a starter for game two. That'll take place about 30 to 45 minutes after game one. We're going to take a one-minute break, and when we come back, we'll give you what Antonio Brown tweeted out yesterday and finish up with some fact or fiction. You're listening to The Shift on 94.5 FM and 1510 AM ESPN Kansas City. Welcome back into The Shift on 94.5 FM and 1510 AM ESPN Kansas City. I'm your host, Jack Johnson, alongside Marco Marquez. Real quick, before we get to some fact or fiction, you saw what Antonio Brown tweeted out yesterday, and it's just, I think it's AB's way of staying in the media. He wants to retire a Steeler. Which Antonio Brown pretty much ran his way out of Pittsburgh. I mean, feuded with coaches, feuded with front office, feuded with Big Ben, about everybody you could possibly feud with. And that was the tumultuous end to his time in Pittsburgh. It was not good. Then he went to the Raiders. He was traded to the Raiders, never played a game for the Raiders. Then made it to New England, played one game with New England. Then made it to Tampa Bay, won a Super Bowl, and then retired middle of the season, middle of the game against the Jets by ripping off his uniform and pumping up the crowd and running out and then getting in an Uber. The saga is never ending. But now he tweeted out he wants to retire a Steeler, but not play for the Steelers. So he wants to probably do one of those one-day contracts. If I'm Pittsburgh, I am giving every middle finger to that man. I am just throwing up the double birds at Antonio Brown saying, you're not coming back here ever. You're not getting what you want. And I think that's what most teams around the NFL are saying to Antonio Brown. You've gotten many chances. You've gotten two chances with Tom Brady, and they still failed. There's no way in hell any other organization out there is looking at Antonio Brown, especially with the way it ended, and said, things will be different. He's out of chances. He's completely out of chances, so he's out of chances to get what he wants to end his career. This will be the end. I think the lasting image for Antonio Brown will be running off the field shirtless.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no way in hell. I mean, maybe if you want to sell some tickets, if you're 1-12, but still, that's not going to be respected by the rest of the league. AB's not even, I mean, he's a good wide receiver still, but he's not worth all the extra stuff that goes into it.
Yeah, you want to retire a Steeler, sign a one-day contract.
But that's the thing, I don't think the Steelers will give it to him.
Yeah.
That's giving AB what he wants, which I think most teams on the NFL are done doing. They're done giving AB that second, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth chance. I mean, everywhere he's gone, he's feuded. He's feuded with coaches, he's feuded with front office. Has there been one situation in his career where he hasn't feuded? Maybe the Super Bowl year with Tampa Bay. He just laid low, knew that they'd win a Super Bowl or get to the Super Bowl.
He played it cool. He didn't have to.
And the minute things looked a little bit bleak in Tampa Bay year two, he blew up, ran off the field, threw his pads off because they tried to get him to play, threw Bruce Arians under the bus. It was ugly. There's no way in hell that there's no way in hell that Antonio Brown gets what he wants to end his career. I think that was it for him. And I think the lesson will be to him, if that's the way you go out at the NFL in this business, where I think a lot of other players may kill their bodies to try to get on a practice squad in the NFL, and he kind of throws it away. He's the only guy in this league I have seen in the last 3 years that has just gotten ample amount of opportunities to turn around his career because of the talent he has. He's a great talent. But now it's too much. It's too risky to bring a guy like AB. There's too much noise, and I think moving forward, no team out there is going to give him what he wants or that seventh chance. What would it be actually now? It'd be Pittsburgh as his first chance. Or I guess if you don't want to count Pittsburgh as his first chance, the Raiders was his first chance or his second chance. Then it was Tampa Bay third, or New England third, Tampa Bay fourth. This would be his fifth chance.
Oof.
I think he's out of chances. Now it is time for some fact or fiction. Five questions, five takes, and well under 5 minutes. Marco, fire away.
Fact or fiction, Joshua Kando has over 3 sacks this season.
I'll go fiction on that because I just can't make that bet not knowing how healthy he'll be. I'm hoping he can have the over on that, but I'm going to say fiction because I just got to have a wait-and-see approach with Josh Kando.
Fact or fiction, the Chiefs signed Jadeveon Clowney or trade for Robert Quinn?
Fiction. You said $11 million in cap space. I feel like they're going to need more than that to get Clowney, and Robert Quinn's going to be very expensive as well, and he's aging.
Mm-hmm.
So the Chiefs are probably going to roll with what they got. They'll only add depth pieces at this point.
Fact or fiction, the Royals split the doubleheader today.
I think at least a split. It's hard to sweep a doubleheader unless the Royals just play horribly today.
Innings, right?
Yeah, 9 innings both, and they got Heasley and Singer on the mound. One of them's going to have a good outing. I'm going to lean towards Singer because Heasley still don't know too much on Heasley. I think he's only made 5 starts in his major league career, but I'll go fact, at least a split.
Fact or fiction, Bobby Witt Jr. has a 2020 season.
Oh, fiction. I think he will steal at least 20 bags, but he's at 3 home runs now. He is heating up. I mean, it wouldn't shock me, but I'm going to go fiction. That might be a little bit overzealous for Bobby Witt Jr. to get a 2020 season.
And lastly, fact or fiction, Antonio Brown retires a Steeler.
Fiction. He's done. I mean, there's just no way that AB gets what he wants. I've said that about 8 times in this segment. No way. No, I think his last game was when he ran off the field shirtless. There's Ray Charles, so that means it's time to go. That wraps up another edition of The Shift on 94.5 FM and 1510 AM ESPN Kansas City. I've been your host, Jack Johnson, alongside Marco Marquez. We'll be back tomorrow at 10 AM. You take it easy, Kansas City.